From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, everybody. Trish Wood here on The Fringe with you all today. And I've got a really interesting guest for the second hour, and his name is Greg Hill. He is the founder of something called Free to Fly. Very interesting guy. He started it, as I understand it, as a result of the onerous vaccine mandates here in Canada and actually around the world for pilots, and has pushed it even farther. He's a very, very interesting speaker on human rights and how that plays into the life of a pilot. But I'm also going to talk to him about how crappy it is to fly now and why that might be happening. I can't figure it out. I mean, like you, I feel like maybe they're doing it on purpose. You know, are they making flying awful because they don't want us to fly? That's what it feels like to me. And you know how I know that's true? Before COVID, I was a big traveler. My husband and I flew to Europe and went to lots of cool places, and I flew a lot for work. I always enjoyed it and looked forward to it as well. I was always happy to go on a business trip. Don't tell my family that, but I kind of liked it, especially if I got bumped up to business. But now I don't, given the hardship and the treatment of passengers like cattle and the lack of accountability on behalf of airlines and, in fact, the governments who regulate them. Like, Pete Buttigieg, where are you? People are sleeping on the floor for days at the airport in Newark. I mean, you know, they should be banging the drum and finding these airlines, but it's just like a collective kind of cluster, you know what? No one takes responsibility, and the end result of it is, as I just said, that nobody wants to fly anymore. So, or many people don't want to fly anymore. In fact, hour one, we're not going to have a guest at all. I'm going to interview myself because I was down last week in Ottawa, Canada, covering the trial of Tamara Leach and Chris Barber, two of the big convoy, trucker convoy people. I'm in the midst of doing a documentary actually about Tamara and peripherally other people too, including Chris, called The Trials of Tamara Leach. The documentary itself is not specifically about the trial, although we're covering the trial. It's more about how the tamping down of this enormously successful populist protest in Ottawa that inspired the world. Let's face it, it was a huge deal. I can't even sometimes, when I look back on it, I can't even believe it happened. It was so miraculous. But the crushing of it by our prime minister through the Emergencies Act also sent a very, very strong message that we are not going to tolerate people who don't share our views. And interestingly, he actually said something along those lines about protesting certain things. You cannot protest certain things. And I, you know what I'm going to do now that I've raised that? I will find that clip for you and play it for you next week, because he did say it was so weird. Like, you can only protest stuff that our prime minister thinks is bad. Like, he loved Black Lives Matter. He took a knee. He took a knee to Black Lives Matter, I believe on Parliament Hill in Ottawa, at a time when they were burning down cities in America, right? But that's fine. But the truckers who were actually peaceful, crime went down in the city of Ottawa during the trucker protest there. But he, you know, they get a completely different treatment, which was the bringing in of these kind of black block looking police. I don't even actually know who they were. I will find that out. It's kind of a mystery. Because the police who were dealing with the convoy in the early days and almost right up until the end, many of them were sympathetic. And there was talk when our prime minister lowered the boom that maybe some of the police would step aside. They so believed in what the truckers were doing, but that didn't happen. And there were police there. Nobody could kind of figure out who they were. I guess we'll find that out. Anywho, as someone who is doing a film about Tamara and Chris and the others and what this means for populist protest. I'm going to mention January 6th. I don't like to tie the two of them together because there was some violence in January 6th. Obviously, nobody was killed except Ashley Babbitt. Let's just put that to bed. I know that Hakeem Jeffries says, oh, five police were killed. That's just a total lie. And Officer Sicknick lay in state in Washington, D.C., as if he were killed on the job. Sad that he died, but he died of a stroke, not at the scene, not hit in the head with a fire extinguisher, as was alleged by the liars crafting the narrative around January 6th. The reason I bring it up, I'm not equating them, because the truckers really were peaceful. There was no violence. Nobody died. No, there was nothing happened in that way, except they annoyed people with honking horns and clogged up some of the city streets. But even while doing that, we're cooperating with police. And I know that to be true because I had audio leaked to me of some of their interactions with the Ontario Provincial Police, who are a little bit different than the Ottawa City Police, the OPS, as they're called, who were being directed to be more aggressive. One of the pieces of evidence we heard was that they were instructed to give not one inch in negotiations. That's not good, right? That's not how you resolve something. So anyway, the hour one, meaning this hour, the hour I'm talking to you during now, is going to be me explaining what I witnessed during the past week. It was quite extraordinary. It's a big deal. It's not like OJ, but when you think about the fact that these two people are on trial for leading, they're accused of leading, they certainly were organizers to some degree of it, this event that there was not any criminality attached to as far as that goes beyond the traffic violations and those sorts of things. It's a big moment, I think, for all of us who questioned vaccine mandates and questioned COVID-19 policy. Let's not forget that that is what it was about. And so I'm going to give you I've covered a few trials in my day as a journalist, and you can never predict what's going to happen in a trial. This is the days in court themselves can be extremely, extremely boring. There are a lot, and this one certainly is, they're going through a whole bunch of, you know, rules of evidence and disclosure, et cetera, housekeeping issues. You're not getting these big dramatic testimonies from people on the witness stand like you do on the TV shows. It's very, you know, like on Law and Order when they finally get to the courtroom part. But the other thing is, even though they can be boring as they're doing kind of procedural stuff and arguing about that, which they are, and I'll get into that in a minute, you also cannot predict what's going to happen. I mean, could you predict OJ? Like I had that completely wrong. Part of me knew he was going to get off just because I felt culturally that was going to happen. It was a vibe I got. And I thought that the prosecutor did a really crappy job of prosecuting the case. But I did feel, despite all of that, the evidence against OJ was overwhelming. Everybody knew he did it. There was terrific blood spatter evidence and her blood in his car and all kinds of stuff that kind of got glossed over by the, you know, if it fits, you must acquit antics of Johnny Cochran. And I just think the prosecutor did a bad job. But when he was acquitted in the way he was, I was pretty flabbergasted. I was worried about it, too. I was worried about a race war connected to the OJ trial, because there was deep, deep division about it. And so the trial in Ottawa, it's not a murder trial. The charges against them are much different and much less inflammatory, although some of them serious. It does express a culture war, specifically in Ottawa, more generally in Canada and around the world, where people who are part of what I'm calling a populist movement, I don't know what else to say, but it's people who are pushing back against, you know, leftist and globalist ideology, seem to be being prevented from being heard, right? The legacy media doesn't cover news stories in honest ways that reflect our views and our issues. They don't hold to account politicians the way they used to and the way they should. So when that happens in a culture, and it's happened around the world and COVID proved it to us, what do you do when all of the institutions in the country in which you live that should be acting as a bulwark of protection in a democracy seem to be captured? And that's what happened around COVID. And I just want to give you this little story about how they fit into the landscape here, if you're listening to this show from outside of Canada and don't quite understand the genesis of it. I'll speak about it very, very personally, because obviously that's all I know. But I was hip to the idea that COVID public policy was dangerous and wrong because I have a science background as a journalist. I covered Tony Fauci during AIDS back in the day. I had limited respect for him then. Now I have none whatsoever. But I knew we were in trouble because lockdowns had never been tried before. It was a methodology without any data. And I also knew that they were getting the infection fatality rate wrong. They were saying it was like 3.4% of people who get COVID are going to die. It was ridiculous. And it was actually Tedros who said that. So I thought, wow, we're in a lot of trouble here, people. So as COVID kind of rolled out and the edicts from public health and government became more aggressive and more nonsensical and less data-based and no risk-benefit ratios being attached to these things like closing schools and kicking kids off ice rinks and all of these ludicrous things that they did, I began to worry. And I guess my faith has always been through these institutions that if the government is failing, if the politicians are failing, which they did, they handed our lives to public health, right, who are captured by leftist ideology and groupthink. We know that now. They were running our country here in Canada and America too, and Australia, New Zealand, and everywhere else. So when that happens, then what do we do when we realize we are in a dangerous spot? What avenues are open to us? And for me, as someone who's covered the courts and various uprisings and problems in the 30, 35 years I've been an investigative journalist, I do have some faith that courts can remedy things. I did have that thought. And what happened just pre the truckers was that these cases against mandates, against lockdowns that were flying in these top expert witnesses like Jay Bhattacharya and other epidemiologists who were testifying with massive credentials that these were huge mistakes, everybody was losing those cases. Done, finished, right? So what happened in this country and elsewhere is that people who did not believe and who knew that the data did not support what they were doing, and if you add to that, that it was harming people, harming our children, what then is open to you to do, right? There were little rinky-dink protests. I used to go down to the McQueen's Park here in Toronto, and I'd go down. They were either Saturday or Sunday afternoon. There'd be a couple of hundred people there with signs and no media covering it. And if they did cover these little protests, they'd say, oh, they were far right or anti-vax or some, you know, absurd epithet attached to it, but that was it. So there was no real civil disobedience kind of pressure being attached to the people governing us and allowing public health to make these rules. There were some big protests in London. I believe there were some in Australia and New Zealand too. But again, the legacy media didn't really cover them, did they? I think there was some in the Netherlands as well, where the cops came in on horseback, if I remember correctly. But they weren't treated the same way that, let's say, the big anti-Iraq war demonstrations were, which I attended in 2003, just before the invasion. They weren't getting any attention. So the people running the country and making those edicts had nothing to worry about, because if the media is not going to apply pressure and accountability questions to them about what they're doing. They can just do whatever they want. And you know what? They were. And we knew, and many, many smart people knew and were horrified, as was I, that what they were doing was not data-based, was not science-based. The idea that there was a consensus about how to deal with COVID-19 was absolute nonsense. They wanted Tony Fauci and public health around the world and these silly, like they had SAGE in England and Ontario, they called the science table, these like-minded group thinky public health bureaucrats and modelers would get together and be supported by government because they wanted the people to believe that there was scientific consensus around what they were doing. And you know what? There wasn't. There was a whole bunch of dissident scientists who were just as esteemed and actually, I would say more so, who were not being given a voice, who nobody was allowed to hear from, who were deplatformed, smeared, lied about, attacked. We all know that story. And we learned the confirmation of it really through the Twitter files, through Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger and David Zweig. But we also learned about it through the Biden v. Missouri case, which is still reverberating for us on a whole bunch of levels. This is the Jay Bhattacharya and others, Kaldorf, I believe, who are suing to make sure the government can't enforce a certain kind of speech on the platform. So anyway, my point was that all of these people were dissident. They were trying to be heard. They weren't being heard. So what do you do then? You're trapped, right? People felt trapped. And for me, and I'd be really curious to know if this is what happened to y'all as well, the moment I realized that there was no democratic way to stop what was happening, and that was probably at lockdown 2 or 3 up here in Ontario, and the things you couldn't do were getting more and more bizarre. That was the point where I was really, really down. I did my podcast all the way through and talked about all these feelings people were having of helplessness. And I remember that as a dark day. And I thought, okay, as a citizen in this country, I know that what they're doing isn't science-based and data-based and unfair. We know the vaccine is certainly not been, at that point, tested long enough to make declarative statements about safety and efficacy. And they were forcing it on people who didn't need it, right? So I'm going to leave that thought with you and go to a break and then just want to sort of tie a bow on where we were, because that's what was happening when the trucker convoy took off. And it was into that sort of valley of despair for those of us who were dissident about it. And I mean informed dissident. Yes, I am a crank, but I also knew from my experience that what they were doing was wrong and harmful. So that is kind of the petri dish and where all of this grew. We're going to go to a break. And when I come back, I will tell you about how the convoy got started. And we'll look a little bit more about the trial that's underway in Ottawa right now. Back in a moment.
Jeremy Nell on TNT Radio.
Another one of the good things that we have going for us is generally a suspicion towards illegitimate authority, the state. I mean, take a look at how we handled Pfizer and Moderna and Jab and all that stuff.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, I mean, I come to that conversation from the complete different, the opposite side, really. I was always very, very trustworthy. I thought, you know, the people that were ruling us would you know, have the best for us at heart. And so it took me quite a long time to turn skeptic, really. I'm fully skeptic today, frankly. And it wasn't COVID. It wasn't COVID. Probably 9/11 was the kickoff for
yes.
Many, of course. I mean, you know, too many questions right from the bat. Then, of course, the financial crisis 2008 was just like a confirmation and just allowed me to go further into the rabbit hole. And then, of course, you know, COVID hit, you know, and by the time COVID hits, and you're not at least a little bit skeptical, I think there's a problem there.
Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
It sounds pretty good.
It sounds real, dude.
Not bad, huh?
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi there, Trish Wood back, and this is kind of a special hour. I'm giving you a bit of a debrief on my week in Ottawa at the trial of Tamara Leach and Chris Barber from the Freedom Convoy case. And I just want to read you what they're charged with, and then I'll get back to this kind of timeline I'm giving you. Mr. Barber and Ms. Leach are facing criminal charges of intimidation, mischief, and obstruction of police, all stemming from their roles in the convoy protest, which filled downtown Ottawa with big rig trucks and brought the area to a standstill for more than 3 weeks in early 2022. The protesters were opposed to pandemic vaccine mandates, and some expressed anti-government views, right? They always throw that in. What does that mean? If you're criticizing public policy, are you anti-government? I mean, this is how I'm reading from Legacy Media, right? I would not have written it that way. Mr. Barber and Ms. Leach also face charges of counseling others to commit each of those three offenses, and Mr. Barber faces a charge of counseling orders others to disobey a court order. So that's kind of the gist. Mischief is a weird charge. It sounds like nothing, but it actually has jail sentences attached to it. Not always. I think this judge has some leeway in sentencing if they are found guilty, but you can go to jail for it. So the way that's written also tells you something about the way Legacy Media see this trial. So where I brought you up to was this idea that in this country and other Western democracies, there was a point, I think, where all of us realized we were in deep, deep, deep trouble, and that the levers of democracy were no longer available to us. There was nothing we could do. I spent weeks thinking I was going to move to Florida because of Ron DeSantis to get away from what was happening here, but obviously I couldn't do that. Because I'm a Canadian citizen, but many of us felt that way. So what happened then? This is a little bit of my story. From covering the show, I heard about these people out west. I didn't know who they were, who were going to do a convoy of trucks across the country to protest the idea of needing a vaccine in order to cross the border for truckers. That was very onerous. And then in the end, the reasons for the protest grew and included all kinds of bad COVID public policy. But that was initially what got them going, because the truckers were one of those groups of people who, while the laptop class were sitting on their Pelotons and ordering in, you know, Uber Eats during the pandemic and having a grand old time, the people like the truckers and the Walmart people and the other people who kept working didn't have that luxury, did they? So it seemed punitive, in a sense, I believe, for the truckers to have to now get vaccinated. Now, interestingly, Chris Barber, one of the people who's charged, is vaccinated. So he's not an anti-vaxxer, as most of the people who didn't want the COVID vaccine were not anti-vaxxers per se, as far as that goes. So what happened, I heard about them coming. I got to interview them a bunch of times on a little live stream I was doing called Coffee with the Convoy, as they drove across this great country heading to Ottawa to make a stand. And it was a miraculous time, I will tell you. Everybody I knew who was a COVID dissident or who had been asking questions was so uplifted by what they did. There were people on the overpasses across the freeways here. It was frigidly cold Canadian winter. And all manner of people, you know, Mennonite ladies giving food and Indigenous people, Indigenous drummers. It was such a Canadian scene. And it kept growing and growing and growing, as the best protests do. And it showed a couple of things, which I think the government thought were quite dangerous. And that is that when Canadians are not being bombarded with propaganda and we can get together in groups, we start asking pretty good questions about how we're being governed, don't we? And that's dangerous. But here's the other thing that was happening. They were raising money like mad. They had a GoFundMe that hit 8 million, 10 million. It just kept going and going and going. And I think what happened is people who were stuck at home feeling hopeless said, well, here's something I can do. I can give money to the convoy. So that's what they did. And that must have been also very, very, very scary for the government, because people were voting with their wallets, weren't they? So this legend grew. It did become a legend across the country, and trucks were coming from everywhere to join in, from all across the country, to go to Ottawa to take this stand. And it went on for 3 weeks, and it was highlighted by, they always make jokes, they had bouncy castles for children and all kinds of wonderful things. Speakers came and went, and lots of Canadians went there just for the weekend in order to feel that they were contributing something during this really, really dark time. And so that's kind of the genesis of it, right? We had hit a wall. There was nothing more we could do as citizens. And this is my opinion, obviously. We were everywhere we turned to try to ameliorate some of the damage being done. We were stopped. Our institutions were failing us, legacy media, the courts, everybody, you know, and the governments, as I said, handed over the country to the public health bureaucrats, which we didn't vote for those people. No, we didn't. So that is the genesis of how the trucker protest got started here. And almost immediately, our prime minister began what was really a smear campaign against them. His very first comments about them, he didn't even know these people, right? But they were from out west, so that's bad if you're a liberal. You know, they were homophobic. It's like the Hillary Clinton thing about Trump supporters, right? Homophobic, blah, blah, blah. And he said, oh, they're a small fringe minority. Wow, was he proven wrong by that? So he set the stage for a negative reaction to the convoy by the citizens of Ottawa. Now, look, the horn honking and the taking over of the streets, obviously that is difficult for people who live there. There's no question about that. But what I learned when I was down there, and this is kind of part two of what I wanted to talk to you about today, was in talking to people in Ottawa about the convoy, many, many people in Ottawa were against the convoy, and many weren't, by the way. Many loved them and supported them. But the ones who were against the convoy and who continue to be against the convoy are people whose information about what happened and what was true and false about the convoy is actually compromised. It's quite interesting, right? So I'll give you an example. We were sitting in our hotel, a nice hotel in Ottawa, really nice people there. And all these people are nice people. None of them are bad people, but it shows how folk tales can kind of spring up around an event if it's encased in government propaganda, right? And so Ottawa is our capital city. That's where the Liberal government is. Many people in Ottawa work for the Liberal government, are liberal in the way they vote. So they're really heavily influenced that way, especially by legacy media who weren't challenging him. Nobody said to Trudeau, how do you know they're misogynistic? Where do you get that? Nobody said that. He just got to say it and frame it, and that was it. So anyway, we're sitting in the restaurant in our hotel, and our waiter, we asked our waiter if the trucks had actually been out in front of this place where we were staying, which was in what they call the red zone. And he said, oh, yeah, so it was terrible. They were parked right there and they were honking and blah, blah, blah. And then he said, and, you know, they found a truck with explosives connected to the convoy. It was terrible. And I said, that's really interesting, because the Public Order Emergency Commission, which did the big on the record under oath investigation into the convoy, didn't address that, nor were charges ever laid by anybody. So, it's one of those stories that, oh, my uncle's cousin's brother said that happened, but it actually didn't happen. And you find when people talk about the convoy, it's kind of like the COVIDian people who are still really afraid of the virus. They tell you stories about, oh, you know, 2,000 children were hospitalized last year with COVID. It's not true. It's a folktale, right? And the same thing happened around the convoy, I think, especially with people who live in Ottawa, but elsewhere too. If you believe in legacy media, then you were fed a bunch of stories that were false, and most of them were debunked by the POEC. I'll name a couple, which I've talked about on the show before. One of them was the arson charge, that there were two people lighting a fire in an apartment building in Ottawa, and someone came in and said, why are you lighting that fire, and who are you? And these two guys allegedly said, oh, we're with the trucker convoy. Really? Like, do you really think that if it actually was trucker people, they would announce? I mean, it was just ridiculous. And then the woman who claims to have had this encounter went upstairs to her apartment, didn't call the cops, she just went to bed while they're lighting the building on fire, right? So not a very credible story on its face, but the media ran with it. Yes, they did. Truckers involved in arson in the capital city. Completely not true. I called the Ottawa police. I spoke to someone involved in the investigation. I'm not going to name him. And he said to me, we knew on day one that the truckers were not involved in that fire. So that's important, because the politicians, and specifically the Ottawa politicians, used that fake arson story to smear the convoy. They did catch the people who did it. Nothing to do with the convoy, but that's like weeks later and everybody's forgotten. But the idea that the convoy is, you know, burning down buildings has already taken root in the population, right? So that was one. Another one, broadcast by CBC, my old employer, is that the convoy was somehow connected to Russia, Russia, Russia. They have to throw Putin in there every time. Also not true. I believe actually even retracted. People should be fired for that stuff. Not just, oh, we're fixing it, but they should be fired in the business. And then the other one was just that all of this money pouring in to the truckers was coming from American far-right extremists, you know, like the Proud Boys or something. And that turned out not to be true. Under oath at the POEC, the head of, I think it's called FinTrack or something, some RCMP way of tracking financial crime, said, no, it just didn't happen. So all of these mythologies grew around the convoy. And the mythologies are what the politicians and the media wanted to pay attention to. So the coverage of the convoy was completely lopsided. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. It was just ridiculous. So that is the kind of stuff that really stuck against them. And the people who love the convoy really love them, and to this day are incredibly loyal. But like COVID and like other issues today, the people who made an opinion about the convoy, it's going to be really, really hard to change their minds. They just believe that. If it's not that story, it's another story. If it's not, you tell them these things have been debunked and they kind of glaze over, you know, the same way they do when you say, well, the vaccines don't prevent transmission. Oh, their faces, right? Their faces glaze over. So I want to get to the trial now and tell you what has been going on in that actual courtroom 5 in the Ottawa Court of Justice building on Elgin Street. So let's take another break, and then I'll come back and I'll wrap up my Freedom Convoy trial coverage hour, and we'll get to Free to Fly in the next hour. Back in a moment.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Old Joe Biden was at it again over the holiday weekend. While speaking in Philadelphia on Monday, Biden continued his habit of bringing up his age.
I tell you what, someone said, you know, that Biden, he's getting old, man. I tell you what. Well, guess what? Guess what? I can, you know, the only thing that comes with age is a little bit of wisdom. I've been doing this longer than anybody, and I guess what? I'm going to continue to do it with your help.
And according to the latest Wall Street Journal poll, Joe isn't alone in noticing his age. 73% said that Biden was too old to handle a second term, and two-thirds of Democrats feel the same way. But apparently it's not about how old you are, it's how old you behave. Biden is 80, but Donald Trump is 77, and only 47% of those polled believe that Trump is too old for the job. And that stat is stunning, and so is this. Biden and Trump are even on who is more compassionate. This despite years of hostile media coverage of Trump. Well, I guess there may be hope after all. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
They've been saying that 2 in 3 deaths on country roads are country people. We might not want to believe it or want to blame others, but think about that final high school year wind cheater. Hey, look at the names. There will be some who've died. Classmates, teammates, friends no longer here. We can't ignore it. 2 in 3 deaths on country roads are country people.
Think road safety. A message from the Government of South Australia.
You're with Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, everybody. I'm back, and I'm just kind of doing a very special debrief for you all after spending a week covering the Freedom Convoy trial in Ottawa. You can read about it on my Substack. I'm doing a Freedom Convoy diary. I've actually got an updated one. I've got it published tomorrow. I haven't got to it yet, but and I've been live tweeting a little bit of it too. Strange that it isn't. I mean, it's getting some attention in the news, but not as much as I thought it would. It's quite remarkable. And interestingly, so this is where I want to go now. There's two stories going on in Ottawa, right? There's a legal case being made by the Crown against Tamara Leach and Chris Barber. So there's that. But then there's also the kind of cultural things that are unfolding around it, as with OJ, right? That race was kind of this overlay and it infected every part of the case. And I think with the truckers, there's this cultural part of it too. It's not really a class struggle because many of the people who supported the convoy were not blue collar, although it was organically a blue collar movement, which is why I think they were so clear headed. You know, the truckers were not befuddled by the scientific propaganda that kind of made the laptop class go crazy and believe stupid things, right? So that happens frequently in the world. Look at the solidarity protest out of Poland. It was the same thing, right? These blue collar people see things quite clearly sometimes, but it's not, the culture doesn't break down that way. It really is, interestingly, that I can tell you, based on whether or not people support the truckers, what else they believe. I can. So they're probably, if they support the truckers, they're probably skeptical of the Ukraine war. They're likely skeptical about the vaccine. They're probably questioning transgender. I mean, is that right? And then on the other side of it, you have all of the opposite things and a demonization of the truckers with these stories that don't hold up under scrutiny. It's kind of wild. So at the courthouse, there were trucker supporters, some of them really interesting. A guy named Tinfoil Hat Man was standing out front. Every trial needs its own eccentric, and he is the guy. So he stands there on a box in a tinfoil hat, waving a large Canadian flag. He supports the truckers, and he seems kind of like a weirdo. But my colleague who was there with me actually interviewed him for the film we're making, and he was quite smart, and he made some really interesting points. And he also apparently was at the POEC, this commission hearing into the Freedom Convoy, every day too. So he's one of these sort of interesting people who appears on these issues looking silly, but actually having interesting things to say. So there was him. There were some really rabid anti-trucker people there, including a woman who was kind of driving around on an adult-sized tricycle, being very verbally aggressive. And interesting, I'm like, what is she so mad about? Why is she so angry at these people? Whether you agree with what they did or not, Chris and Tamara are really lovely, gentle people, right? So what is the anger about? I don't know. I guess it's from the propaganda. So there was that going on outside, two groups of people, supporters and non-supporters, people with signs saying free Tamara, free Chris, you know, and that sort of stuff. And then there was in the first couple of days a fair bit of media, you know, the cameras clicking as people came and went from the courthouse and that sort of thing. And then inside the courtroom, on the left-hand side facing the judge is the Crown table, led by a guy named Tim Radcliffe, who I'll talk about in a minute. Very strange way of presenting his case. And legacy media are lined up kind of on that side. Some of them are on the other side, but they're mostly sitting behind the Crown, which they may do all the time. I'm sure they do that all the time anyway. And then on the other side of the courtroom is the defense, two tables, because each defendant, Chris and Tamara, have their own lawyer. Chris's lawyer is Diane Magus, who's amazing, very tough lady. And Tamara's lawyer is a kind of a famous criminal attorney in Ottawa named Lawrence Greenspan. And on that side are the convoy supporters. But here's what's interesting. That really looks a bit like class struggle, right? Because the left-hand side, the journalists, laptop class, little suits, you know, kind of buttoned down looking. And then the other side is more casual and more kind of blue collary looking. If I can say that without being offensive, I don't mean to be, but that's kind of what the visual is. So here's how it's been breaking down. This case, or the Crown, let me say this, the Crown's case is to try to show that Chris and Tamara were leading people to do illegal things, right? So as part of that, they are presenting all of this video evidence, which is fascinating. It's stuff I hadn't seen. Some of it's police body cam stuff. And what is coming through the TikToks that Chris Barber did, the body cam footage, other videos that the Crown has been playing in court, is that, and this is against Chris mostly right now, and that is that Chris is a really interesting and apparently decent person, right? A lot of the stuff he's saying in these videos is stay peaceful, be peaceful, you know, no violence, be like Gandhi. Like, it's really it, so it must be weird for the Crown to be presenting, I don't know why they're presenting this evidence that shows exactly what everybody knew, which is that the protests were based on passive, you know, resistance and peaceful protest. That's absolutely clear from the TikToks of Chris Barber that they're playing. So I don't know what they're thinking about that. At one point, Chris does implore people to come to Ottawa. So I'm sure the Crown will have a way of presenting that fits his case in some way or another. But I don't quite understand what the Crown is doing here. And that's just me. And he has not made his arguments yet. So he will hopefully thread the needle going forward. But it's very interesting to watch the Crown prosecuting people by playing videos that make them look like really great people. It's quite, you know, the accused look like really great people. I think the big issue right now in this trial, and this is what happened on, well, gosh, it was just yesterday. You know, I spent the whole day most of a day in an Ottawa courtroom yesterday, grabbed my suitcase from the hotel, hopped a train back to Toronto. It was about a 4.5-hour train ride, got home really late, and then got up to do this show for y'all. But I'm glad I didn't miss yesterday. I'll tell you why. Because even though it was deadly boring, something strange is happening. And I want to say this without being irresponsible, but the Crown, it would appear, and this was a complaint made by Diane Magus, the lawyer for Chris Barber, is not divulging what they call disclosure, which is the elements of his case against Chris as he sees it, right? In a timely fashion to his counsel. I mean, that's kind of standard, like criminal law 101. And there was a huge kerfuffle about it yesterday. She made a complaint that some element of the case, I think they were either text messages or digital messages or something, had only been dropped on her like a day before trial or something. That's not exactly right. But, you know, without giving her enough time to review them so that she could present a defense to them. That's just a no-no. It's not done. And I have watched this judge, who I admire, actually. I hope it's not misplaced, but I admire her, the way she's running the courtroom. Her name is Justice Heather Perkins McVeigh. And yesterday she was so upset. She said more than once, "I'm not happy" or "I'm unhappy" or something. And she was directing it at the Crown, who seems to not be able to manage the volume of material. These got, you know, hundreds of messages and lots of TikToks and police body cam and all this. And all of those things need to be cataloged and in a certain way and given to the court as exhibits and given to the defense as exhibits. And that is not apparently happening in the way it should. That's been going on all week. Right. So instead of having these big dramatic, you know, cross examinations on the witness stand, we're having housekeeping arguments between a little bit between the defense and the Crown, but mostly between the Crown and the judge. And that is not good, people. That is not good. Now, I admire the judge. She's keeping her cool. She's got a little bit of a sense of humor, which is great and needed during these times. But I don't know what. I don't understand what the crown is doing here. If he, you know, I don't want to say he doesn't know what he's doing. Obviously he does. He's Crown Attorney, but he keeps digging in deeper and deeper with the court itself. And I will say this, that the judge even said yesterday that the proceedings, I'm quoting here, have the potential to go off the rails, and stress the importance of clearing up what evidence the prosecution intends to put before the court, right? So the defense lawyers have to know what he's going to do. And they should have known what he's going to do weeks ago so they could prep for it. And that's not happening. So there's one of two things. Either he's deliberately obfuscating, and I would never make that allegation, or he is a very kind of mistake-prone manager of his case. I don't know what other explanation there could be for this, but the judge was so upset yesterday, she had to take a break and leave the courtroom. So, yeah. Now, I also want to say that the lawyers for the convoy people are expensive. And so what was going to be, as of Monday or Tuesday when the case started, Tuesday, it was going to be a 16-day trial, right? Now, after 4 days of this kind of monkey business and the ongoing housekeeping discussions and non-calling of witnesses, et cetera, this poor police officer who was going to testify about the video evidence was back and forth to the witness stand and barely got a chance to speak because every time there was some procedural thing they had to go through. So what this means for the defendants in the case is that their legal bills go up, up, up. And my bills go up, 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 because if I want to be there to report on this, you know, I leave the city where I live and I take the train down there and I stay in a hotel and it goes on and on and on. So it's a very, very interesting moment we're at in this trial now. And I would never say that things are going well because a ton of evidence has not been led aside from TikToks and various videos. And they don't seem to really say that much. And we don't really know what the Crown's going to do with them anyway. And Chris and Tamara are coming off like pretty cool people. But what is the law actually going to do about certain things that are said? It's hard to know. I don't have a sense of it, actually. I have a sense that I like the judge. I have a sense that Diane Magus, who is Chris Barber's lawyer, is really sharp, and that Lawrence Greenspan is as well. But there's real frustration in that courtroom right now. And so we'll see where that goes. What wasn't helping the mood at all is that Ottawa was kind of like Southern Gothic. It was so hot that just walking from my hotel room to the courthouse, which was about three blocks away, I would get there and I was sweating like a dirty dog. I'm telling you, it was very, very hot and humid. And that kind of wet environment where it makes it almost a little bit hard to breathe because the air is so heavy. So that was the environment in which this case is going. And I'm going back. I'm going to go back next week. I might do the show from there next week, actually. It won't make any difference whether I'm there or here because, you know, I'm still just talking to you over a microphone. But yeah, so this has been for me a very, very momentous event. And I do kind of believe in the justice system still. I kind of do. I don't like that these charges were brought in a sense. I think the argument that I would make and will be discussing, I hope, with some great legal minds. I'm going to have a conversation with Bruce Pardee about this at some point, is that as a citizen, if the government, as we began this discussion at the top of the hour today, if the government is doing things that you believe are dangerous for the country and for your fellow citizenry, and all avenues of reproach and remedy have been closed off, as they were during COVID, legacy media, courts, everything not listening to us, what do you do? What do you do? What do you do? And when does our right to practice civil disobedience peacefully trump whatever laws may be infringed upon, if indeed they were infringed upon, in order to make that case, right? There has to be a point where someone says there was a higher purpose here. And what I fear is that if Tamara and Chris lose this, there will be one of two things is going to happen, in my opinion. People will either be super angry in not a good way, and I hope that doesn't happen, or even worse for us all is that we will stop participating in democracy, right? I mean, we saw the sentences for the January 6th people, and they were way over the top. What is that going to do to people who want to protest or who feel an election has been stolen, as they are apparently in America frequently now? The idea that we can't have a voice without risking criminal charges is a very, very dangerous one for a democracy. So that's why this trial is important. I wish they would get to evidence. I want to see some dramatic cross-examinations. I want to see these lawyers in top form doing what good lawyers do in a criminal trial. But that may be days away based on all the housekeeping that needs to be done. And I fear that this thing may go on for, well, she said 16 days. It's been four, so that makes 12. It may go on for another week or so after that. Nobody wants it. But we're going to keep you informed about it. And I will have, over the next couple shows, a guest or two who have been in the courtroom, hopefully, who can talk a little bit about it. And then when it wraps up, I'll do more, because I think these issues really, it's a microcosm here in Ottawa, Canada, but these issues are the issues of our time. How do we protest when we feel the government isn't listening, that democracy isn't working, that our institutions have been captured? What do we do then? So that's why this is an important story for me. Plus, I know Tamara and Chris. I like them as, for what that's worth. You know, that doesn't exonerate them. It's only my opinion, but my experience with them has been that they're both decent and thoughtful people who are sincere in what they're trying to do. And I will, there was a joke going around the courtroom. I'll leave you guys with this for this hour and then we'll come back with a guest. But the convoy was very well run. They had road captains and wonderful organizers meeting with cops. And somebody said, gee, if the convoy had been running the Crown's case, maybe it would have been a little bit better organized. That's a low blow, but that's what people were saying. Anyway, I will be back to talk about Free to Fly in a few minutes. This is Trish Wood, TNT Radio.